Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tristram, said he, etc. So Tristram, I was called, and Tristram shall I be to the day of my death.
And I'd been really stuck, and I stayed here, and Patrick said, well, have a little write in the morning. I mean, it just flowed out of me. It was amazing. But I think that's what Tristram Shandy does. It sets you free.
What you're holding in your hand is something which is about to explode with ideas, so many ideas that have hardly been touched upon.
I wish either my father or my mother, or indeed both of them, as they were in duty both equally bound to it, had minded what they were about when they begot me. Those are the first words of the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, the genre-busting, postmodern 18th century novel that contains very little about Tristram Shandy's life and opinions, and an awful lot about how difficult it is to write the book that we're reading. Its author, Lawrence Stern, had been an obscure Anglo-Irish clergyman for most of his life, but he said that he wrote not to be fed, but to be famous, and in that he succeeded spectacularly. After the publication of Tristram Shandy, Stern was feted in London and Paris, he became close friends with the actor David Garrick, and he had his portrait painted by the most eminent artist of the day, Joshua Reynolds. His writing has influenced authors from James Joyce and Thomas Mann, to Samuel Beckett and Salman Rushdie, and in 1878, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche called him the most liberated spirit of all time. Hello and welcome to On the Road with Penguin Classics, the podcast that takes a stroll around the world's favourite books. I'm Henry Elliott, the author of the Penguin Classics book, and in this episode, we're going to digress around the little village of Coxwold in North Yorkshire, where Stern lived and wrote most of the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy. We're in the churchyard in Coxwold. I'm looking out across fields. We're in a little eminence in a kind of beautiful green valley. It's rather a damp morning in October, and I'm joined across the grave today by the children's writer Frank Cottrell Boyce. Frank, welcome.
It's great to be here. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Frank's the author of Millions, the children's book that won the Carnegie Medal, and various sequels after that. He's also written several sequels to the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang story by Ian Fleming. He wrote the 2012 Olympic opening ceremony, directed by Danny Boyle. And Frank is also very well known as a screenwriter. He's written the screenplays for films such as Hillary and Jackie, Goodbye Christopher Robin, 24-Hour Party People. As well as that, he's the professor of reading at Liverpool Hope University. So perfect job to have to be with us today. But Frank, you're also the author of the screenplay for the unfilmable film adaptation of Tristram Shandy, which came out as a cock and bull story in Britain.
Yeah.
I guess, why don't we start? How do you describe the book Tristram Shandy to people who haven't heard of it? What is this book?
I think that phrase that you've got from Nietzsche about a liberated spirit, the book is the liberated book. I think one of the reasons that artists and writers direct each other towards it, it's like there's this thing that people say about the first Velvet Underground album, which is that only 1,000 people bought it, but they all formed bands.
Right.
That reading Tristram Shandy is a huge, it's a kind of blessing, and it kind of sets you free, because you read that book and you think, oh, I didn't know you were allowed to do that right. in a book.
Yes.
Which is kind of extraordinary, because it's so close to the beginning of the novel, uh-huh. and he just tears up the real book, you know? So it's, I think that's the kind of spirit of it. The story of it is, I mean, the story that I take from it yeah. as a dad is it's the story of a man trying to prepare the best start in life for his son. It's right. a very, very warm book. It's yes. very human, very domestic.
And as I mentioned, it sets out to be the life and opinions of the author. And he hardly gets anywhere, right? He's kind of, he doesn't get born to the middle of volume three.
No, it's a book about the frustration of plans, isn't it? And we are standing next to Lawrence Stern's grave.
Yes.
But not all of Lawrence Stern yes. is in this grave.
Well, tell us more about that. We've just
because
discovered
Lawrence
this.
Stern was buried in London, and where we are standing, only his skull and femur are buried. And it's the skull and the femur because the skull and the femur is the least that you can have together to guarantee your physical resurrection on right. the last day. So,
well, that's a relief. At least it's...
We couldn't even be buried properly.
No, right, like, yes.
The book is about being born wrong, and this is about we are standing where he was buried badly.
I had never thought of that, of course. Yes, but I think it's a good place to start talking about the book because death runs through Tristram Shandy, and he was struggling with illness throughout writing it, struggling with tuberculosis.
Yeah, I was thinking on the drive up today, I was thinking, you know, this is a book that's haunted by a cough.
Yes.
He keeps coughing
right.
all the way through the book.
And it's
and the writing of the book is a race against time in two dimensions, because he can't write fast enough to tell you to keep up with how fast life is happening,
mm-hmm.
but he's also trying to write fast enough to finish before death gets him.
Oh, gosh,
which,
yes.
you know, and we're standing at his grave.
Yeah,
goodness. And, of course, one of the best known and most sort of joyous aspects of this book are the games he plays with typography and sort of the rules of bookmaking.
Yeah.
And I suppose maybe the most famous page in the book is the entirely black,
the black page.
Pair of pages, which marks the death of Parson Yorick, the kind of friend of the family.
Yeah.
Maybe, Frank, would you be happy to read
I'd be thrilled to.
This little description of Yorick's gravestone?
Okay. And Yorick is not at all Lawrence Stern. Honestly. He lies buried in a corner of his churchyard in the parish of Dash, under a plain marble slab, ... with no more than these three words of inscription serving both for epitaph and elegy. Alas, poor Yorick.
Brilliant. And actually, you know, we'll talk about this more, but in strange ways, Lawrence Stern kind of blended his own real life with this book.
And yeah, well, you read that quote before, which is, I write to be famous and not to be fed, uh-huh. which is a flip, I think, of, is it Sinner who said, I write to be fed and not to
right.
be famous?
Right, okay.
Everything is something else. So, like, but he loved being famous. He
yes.
really, he was the celebrity author.
Uh-huh. So,
and you'd have loved, you know, the festival circuit. He'd have loved Hay on Wye.
Yes, right, he would
yeah,
have been.
He'd have loved Front Row and all those things. He'd have been Melvin Bragg's best guest, right. you know.
And he kind of adopted this persona of his fictional character, Yorick, right? He published his sermons under the name Yorick. And Yorick is an interesting name for him to adopt because, of course, the main association we have with it is the dead jester from Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's death again. It's a skull that Hamlet holds up.
Yeah.
But he was also a jester who could make
yeah.
people laugh. And there's, you know, there's two elements of laughter and death run throughout this book.
I yeah, think. No, absolutely. That's yeah, and it's not, it's the closer the bone, the sweeter the meat, isn't it? It's there's
right.
the really big laughs are to be got from the darkest
uh-huh.
things.
Uh-huh.
And that is what Tristram Shandy does.
We should say that Stern had taken holy orders. He was perpetual curate here at Cotswold. And so this was his church. He would walk here to preach here. So, well, let's head in and look inside the church.
Okay.
It's a beautiful stone porch here. They've got a kind of bird, little bird guard gates.
Oh, right. I've not been in here
wow.
before. Wow.
You know, you can imagine Stern standing in that pulpit. We're standing in this medieval church. It's rather kind of broad, isn't it? The dimension, it feels quite wide and spacious. And then the main body of the church, there are box pews, which I believe Stern had put in himself. And then through a stone arch, we can see the altar and the altar rail up.
But off to one side of the arch is this power pulpit.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Which he definitely had installed. You know, this is my rider.
Definitely.
You can and see. It's shaped like a spotlight or something. It's, yeah. So he was really, it's not really hit me before ever. I've lived with this book since I was about 18. It's not really hit me before. He was a performer, mm-hmm. you know, before he was anything else. Mm-hmm. He was a star preacher. You know, people loved to hear him preach, and they'd come and his sermons would be published, and he'd be paid to preach in York. And all those sort of typographical things in the book, which as a kind of, you know, English student, you're saying, oh, this is about playing with the conventions of typography and narrative. This is an attempt to kind of reproduce performance, isn't it? Right. He's trying to put, because he would have stood in that pulpit and said a line, and then there would have been a pause, you know, for a giggle or, and the book is full of these attempts to replicate the pause. You know, there's no book ever that invites you to read between the lines quite like Tristram Shandy, because it's like, because he will leave spaces between the lines.
Do you know, it reminds me of the Marx Brothers movies, which they used to show them on road trips, on test audiences, and listen to where the laughs came. And then they'd re-edit the film to make sure they left enough of a gap in the film so the laugh could die down, because they only knew it would be performed live.
Wow.
And it reminds me of that. He must have known how to hold a crowd
absolutely.
And the effects of...
Well, and he became he ended up performing, being Yorick, didn't he? And so on and so forth. But he would have stood up there, and there would have been these pauses on bits where it would go fast, and gestures. Like the book is full of attempts to represent gesture. This diagram of the flourish of the cane, Trim throwing his hat down, and these like very dramatic gestures. He would have done all that up there.
Frank, how did you first? You mentioned that you've known it since you were 18. How did you first
younger, actually. I was in the sixth form and a really terrific English teacher who was not unlike Uncle Toby.
Really?
He was a sort of big lumbering. You know, Uncle Toby's a military man. And Mr. Biggs was big and he'd been a rugby player and he was very soft-spoken and very gentle and we all absolutely adored him. And in lower sixth, he gave me a copy of Tristram Shandy and he said, "You'll like this." And I tried to, just did not get it at all. But I wanted to be the boy that he thought I was. So I headbutted my way through that book. And bits of it stayed with me. And I didn't get it, but I did it, you know. And then when we had our first child, Tristram Shandy just exploded in my brain. Like, all the anxieties, all the kind of, you know, is there another book about, you know, what are we going to call the baby? Or a book, like it's an 18th century book. And like when we had our first child, there was loads of discussion. That's the beginning of the National Childbirth Trust and stuff like that. Whole kind of philosophical discussion about how a baby should be born and the importance of the first few minutes of a baby's life and bonding with the mother. These were huge, huge things that were going on philosophically when we were having children. And they're all there in Tristram Shandy. I mean, in comic form.
Yes.
And something kind of very balmy and reassuring about them that's like, you will have a birth plan, it will go terribly wrong.
Yes, right. Nothing will go to plan.
You know, there was something really warm and reassuring and charitable about that.
Yes. And you're right. As we'll discuss, there's very little plot in the book. But what there is mostly about Tristram's father, Walter Shandy, trying to be a good father.
Wanting the world to be a better place and but not getting it and being detached and not really understanding it. And
It's a wonderful... When Tristram's born, he decides to write the Tristopedia, this book that will give Tristram everything he needs at every stage of his life. But he's taking so long to write it. But Tristram's growing up while he's writing it. So huge swathes become
And he's
useless.
Missing out on Tristram growing up because he's busy writing this encyclopedia.
Oh, gosh. While we're here, you know, talking about Stern as a clergyman, there's one bit in the book maybe we should mention, which is a bit of a set piece earlier on when they come across a sermon in an old book. And I think it's Corporal Trim.
The abuse of conscience, is it?
The abuse of conscience. He picks up this old book and shakes it. The description is, he took hold of the two covers of the book, one in each hand, and letting the leaves fall down as he bent the covers back, he gave the book a good sound shake. Really physical description. And what happens in the story is this loose sermon falls out, which they then read. But it's such a clever trick because they read the sermon, so the sermon is included in the book that we're holding in our hand. So, if the book had been bound a bit loosely, we could have picked up our own book and shaken it, and this sermon would have fallen out. And then the extra twist is that that sermon is almost verbatim a sermon that Sterne himself had preached at York. And so, again, it just one of the examples of him playing with reality and blending different levels of...
And also... That sort of cutting and pasting thing that he would do, that he'd take things from, or sampling, like in modern dance music or something like that. They would sample things. So he'd take his own sermon and put it in. But there's also that great speech about plagiarism in the book, which is completely plagiarised. It's plagiarised from Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, where it's not really Burton either, because that's the whole point of the Anatomy of Melancholy is that's a cut-up of other sources. So even the original thing that he's plagiarising it from, he sort of plagiarised anyway. So it's like when you listen to Uptown Funk and you listen to it and think, oh, that's the bit from Let's Dance and I love this bit from, whatever. You can hear that it's a collage of other songs, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Brilliant. So this is the route, I guess, Sterne would have walked very regularly back and forth
to the parsonage.
Yeah.
He'd had a very kind of chaotic life, hadn't he, to this point?
Yeah, that's
He'd
right.
Moved back and forth between Ireland and England. He'd been at school in Yorkshire.
That's right. And then he did then take holy orders, kind of with the help of his uncle, who was a canon at York Minster.
But then there's this brilliant twist, isn't there? The uncle says, you can go to this school and I'll sort you out.
Yeah.
And then lands him with a bill for it afterwards.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
He ended up having to pay his own school fees retrospectively. Like a student loan.
Yes, right.
So he's very modern, you know. So he was burdened with this debt.
And so for about 20 years, he lived in a village not that far away from here called Sutton-on-the-Forest. And he was the local vicar there, I suppose, a parson. And that's where he wrote the first two volumes of Tristram Shandy. And then it was the success of those that allowed him to move to a larger home. And that's when he moved to this house just up the road here. And that's where he wrote the rest of Tristram Shandy and his final book, A Sentimental Journey. So we've walked along the road, coming sort of out of the village of Coxwell, really, and we've come to the edge of the village, and here is a really beautiful red brick and stone house. And it's kind of hard to describe because it's a real sort of hodgepodge of bits that have been sort of added on here and adapted there. And
it's very cute.
It is.
If you made a model of it, it would be like Sylvanian families or something like that.
It's got two gables with sash windows in them, but then a pair of chimneys sort of added on the right, and then a rather sort of formal Georgian construction on the left-hand side. This is where Lawrence Sterne came to live, and he called it Shandy Hall, the name of Tristram Shandy's home in the first two volumes that he'd written. I mean, it's such a crazy idea. I think if we walk round to the front door...
Yeah, you can't imagine anyone. You can't imagine J.K. Rowling calling her house Hogwarts.
Hogwarts.
And making it look a bit like Hogwarts. And then retro-claiming that it was Hogwarts. There's nothing grand about it, is there? It's a big house, but it's not grand. It's not intimidating in any way. It's very inviting.
It really is inviting. Hello.
Be careful of the steps. The ancient steps. Worn by your feet.
Would you like to come through to the kitchen? Brilliant. Or the old kitchen?
Thank you.
There we are.
God, what a beautiful room. And you've got the fire going. That's
the fire's going too, which is good. Yeah.
we've just stepped into the kitchen of Shandy Hall, and we've been invited in by the curator and custodian of Shandy Hall, Patrick Wildgust. Patrick, thank you very much for having us in here. Patrick, for people who haven't visited Shandy Hall, can you describe the house, where we are?
Well, we're standing in the framework of what was a timber-framed hall, dating from 1430.
Right.
It's one of what was a row of medieval houses that went down all this side of the road.
Oh, interesting.
And it's taken on its different identity now. I mean, it's a true literary house, because it's not where he was born or died, which is often accident,
yes,
but it's where he wrote.
Right.
Yeah.
And you, Frank, know that, because you wrote a bit.
I wrote a chunk of my book in his... It's one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me.
Oh, it was great.
What was the book you
wrote? It was called Cosmic, and I'd been really stuck. And I was like, and I stayed here, and Patrick said, well, have a little write in the morning. And I went, it just flowed out of me. It was amazing.
Great.
And it's still the best thing I've written, really. So
good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tapping
yeah.
into the
aura. And I think that's what Tristram Shandy does. It just, like we were saying before, it sets you free.
Why don't we talk about some of the characters a little bit more? Because we've been mentioning Uncle Toby and Walter. And Frank, would you be happy to give us a rundown of who's in this book? Who are the characters?
Well, weirdly, the star is Toby, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think, and Toby is the character that carried this book to fame, I would say.
And everybody loves.
And everybody loves him. And he's probably the most lovable, openly lovable character in fiction. He's this guy who was injured at the Siege of Namur. He's back from the war. His valet is his Batman. Would Trimmer be a Batman? Yeah. It's the most... If we talk about timing in Tristram Shandy and comic timing, there's a joke, and it's like 300 and odd pages before it pays off, and it's worth it.
Yeah.
Right?
It burns slowly, doesn't it?
Very, very slow. Yeah. Slowest burn, which is the question of where Toby was injured.
Right, right.
And there's also this wonderful... We were just talking about how what a performer Stern was. It has this great riff that whenever anything gets difficult...
Yes.
Toby just whistles Little Bolero, which is incredibly difficult to represent on the page.
Yes.
But as soon as you start reading it out, it's brilliant.
I think it was William Hazlitt who said that Toby is one of the finest compliments ever paid to human nature.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's good, isn't it?
And he became a kind of role model, didn't he? Mm. And a cult. And people wanted to sort of meet Toby and be like one of those characters that seems more alive than a lot of people. Well, in fact, I think in Germany there's a grave. Someone buried Uncle Toby.
They created graves for the characters from Tristram Shandy.
Yeah. Okay.
It's quite extraordinary. Yeah.
So Uncle Toby, and so who else is in this book?
Well, there's Uncle Toby. Well, Uncle Toby's got his sidekick, which is Trim.
Corporal Trim.
And Toby is courted by the widow Wadman.
Yes.
And which is just the richest, most wonderful thing, because he has no idea how to deal with women, and she's very forthright. Like, anatomically, there are things she wants to know about him, which he doesn't have any vocabulary for. Or he does, but he thinks it's a vocabulary about fortifications.
You do that so well in the film adaptation with Rob Brydon playing Uncle Toby. He delivers those lines so well. I was injured exactly here. Where he's standing. And the Widow Wadman's a wonderful character, isn't she?
Brilliant.
One of the brilliant tricks that Stern plays is at one point he's trying to describe what she looks like, and then he just gives up and says, look, here's a blank page, you draw a picture of her and you'll know.
Paint her to your own liking.
I mean, and then there's Walter, who's Tristram's dad, who is the kind of structural core of everything, because he's the one who has the narrative in his head of how all this should go.
And he's the index of
how absy everybody is, you know.
And he feels like he's very... He's read his lock. He's sort of got all his up-to-date philosophy and medical knowledge, and just nothing goes to plan.
And nothing relates to anything that's actually happening around him. And he's the one who's got this very modern kind of view of childbirth. So he wants a doctor there with the right equipment.
Right.
But just sadly, that doctor turns out to be
Dr. Slop.
Whose name should have told you. It's so funny, isn't it? Because like, one of Walter's things is that you have to have the right name.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
So I've got to give you... But he somehow doesn't notice that a doctor called Slop
is not going to be necessarily very good.
The description of Slop is a little, squat, uncourtly figure of Dr. Slop of about 4 feet and a half perpendicular height, with a breadth of back and a sesquipedality of belly, which might have done honour to a sergeant in the Horse Guards. Basically a kind of ball.
So he wants this forceps delivery, whereas the wife wants an NCT home birth. So it's the, it is modern versus, the forceps doesn't go well.
Brilliant. Well, that's a brilliant précis of the characters. So, Patrick, you've brought in the first edition of... I mean, Frank, do you want to describe what we're seeing here?
The first thing that strikes you is that these are little books, that your experience of Tristram Shandy is picking up this weighty tome.
Exactly.
And these are little, and they fit in your pocket.
Yeah.
And they look like little pocket rockets, you know?
Same size as Johnson's Rasselas, and he got that idea from it. Yeah.
Oh, there it is, a black page that we were just discussing.
And it's not as black as it was.
No, they vary, obviously, from each, depending on how it was...
Because it took a lot of ink to make that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I've shown this to printers, I've shown this to engravers, and nobody has been able to come up with an absolute definite that's how it was made.
It's lovely to see it there like this, because it's very faded, it's very variegated. It doesn't look like the black page, does it? It looks like it's inviting you through. There's a doorway. Alas, poor Yorick.
Alas, poor Yorick.
Yes, it feels more like a sort of like a portal in the page, doesn't it, when you see it there. And so he would write, while he was writing Tristram Shandy, about two volumes a year was what he was aiming for, right? And he has that great line where he says, when he'd written five volumes, he says, "As we've got through these five volumes, do, sir, sit down upon a set. They're better than nothing. Let us just look back upon the country we have passed through." And now they're stacked up. They do look like, you could imagine a tiny little stool.
But they do look like, collect the set, don't they?
Yes.
They look good together.
Okay, so let's move through next door into the room where we think Sterne wrote the volumes of Tristram Shandy.
This is it. This is the writer's equivalent of the time vortex.
Aha.
This is it. This is the... Oh, it's such a cabinet, isn't it? It's a little cabinet.
It's a beautiful room.
It's completely lined with books. It's got this lovely window.
And this is theoretically one of the largest collections of editions of Sterne. We've got the sermons, the letters.
You can really imagine Sterne sitting in this room with the sun streaming in as it is now. I mean, one of the things that happens in the book is that he's constantly reminding you that he is writing and sort of describing the circumstances of the writing of the book.
Yeah.
And, there's several moments where he describes the exact time and date that he's got to at the moment of writing. And this little passage is fun to imagine while we're standing in here.
"It's not half an hour ago when, in the great hurry and precipitation of a poor devil's writing for daily bread, I threw a first sheet, which I had just finished and carefully wrote out, slap into the fire instead of the foul one. Instantly, I snatched off my wig and threw it perpendicularly with all imaginable violence up into the top of the room. Indeed, I caught it as it fell."
Such a...
So say, you see it. Like,
you can really picture it, can't you?
I've got to say, the top of the room is not very far away.
No.
It's not a big throw, that. But then he was ill, wasn't he?
He was ill.
That's true, yeah. So why don't we, while we're in this room where he wrote a lot of the book, why don't we talk about the writing of this book, which is one of the themes that comes back again and again in the book. I mean, one of the things he talks about is how slow the progress is.
Yeah.
How hard it is to sort of get through this. He says, "I declare I've been at it these 6 weeks, making all the speed I possibly could, and I'm not yet born." And that's one of the lines you really pick up on in the screen adaptation. But the film keeps getting ahead of itself, and you say, "But I'm not yet born," and we kind of rewind and start again.
Yeah. I mean, it's always like the difference, which goes to the theme of it, isn't it? That you have an idea for a book, and it's suddenly very clear to you, and you think, "Oh, great, I'll just do that." And then, of course, it takes forever to do it. And it's very painful. And you forget what the idea that gave you that spark was, which is the same as growing up, isn't it? "I've got this great idea for a life that I'm going to have."
Right.
Yes.
He's live streaming, isn't he? That's the feel of it. It's like, I'm live streaming the writing of a book.
The experience that I'm having now.
And it's the business of writing it. So it's kind of overtaking the actual book, and it is interactive. We talk all the time about especially when we talk about classic literature, as if it's a solitary pursuit that is consumed in a solitary way, which is extremely difficult when you're talking about comedy, because nobody really laughs out loud on their own, And I think it does happen in Tristram Shandy, and part of it is this very clever thing that he does, which is that he's got a reader in the book with him. So you're not reading it on your own.
Yes.
Because there's a reader there on page one saying, what what did your father say when he was interrupted? Yes. And just and Stern says nothing.
Yeah,
it's just like, and yes, you've got someone advice. Else, and it's yeah. it's like you as a reader know that when the father is interrupted, he's not interrupted when he's talking; he's interrupted because he's having sex. But the reader goes, "What? When you say he was interrupted, what was he saying?" It's like, "Oh, nothing." So you've got a stupid reader in the book.
Right, and sometimes there's more than one reader because do you remember that bit where he starts a new chapter and says, now, I told you in the last chapter that my mother was not a papist, he says.
Yeah.
And a female reader says, what? I missed that bit. He says, okay, you have to go back and reread that chapter. Then you imagine that reader going back and he carries on talking to you reading the book. Yeah. And then that reader comes back and joins you and like, now, did you see what I mean?
But it's extraordinary to carry the understanding of that device, isn't it? The idea that you can give birth to that sort of idea.
Oh, yeah, hugely. But also I think what's, like, on a practical level, when you watch a live comedian, the best bit is when they pick up something from the beginning of the routine and bring it back.
Right.
And that's wonderful. Yeah. And that's the essence of comedy. It's really hard if you're writing because it was months ago that you wrote that line.
Yes.
And you don't remember that you wrote that and you've got to go back to find it. So that going back and forth in the book, which he's compelling the reader to do, that's what you have to do if you're trying to write something funny. You've got to keep remembering that you set this up. That's the art of it. And I think the other thing is that the readers that he puts in the book are stupid.
Mm.
So you feel smart. And then you're encouraged to show how smart you are by laughing at the jokes.
Right.
You know, I get it. This person didn't get it. I get it. I completely get that they were having sex. You know?
He sets it up, the writing of it, as a kind of impossible super task, doesn't he? He says, I'm this month one whole year older than I was this time 12 month, and having got, as you perceive, almost into the middle of my fourth volume, and no farther than to my first day's life, 'tis demonstrative that I have 364 days more life to write just now than when I first set out. So he's kind of...
Do the
he's writing, exactly. It's kind of... If it takes him a year to write a day, it's going to be a problem.
The paradox, Well, the other thing that's interesting about the publication of Stern's books in there while he was still alive is that in volumes 5, 7, and 9 of Tristram Shandy, he signs every copy.
No.
Every copy?
Every copy of volumes 5, 7, and 9.
No. Wow. So look,
so there are people going around London saying, I have a rare unsigned copy. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And this was supposed to perhaps deter...
Were there pirate editions or something?
Fanfic was big, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is it Christopher Wagstaff? There was a book called The Night Rambler. He wrote these books about moving around London at night.
Really?
That have like a Shandian dash in.
Oh,
and
do
then
they?
After, but they predate Tristram Shandy. And then when Tristram Shandy came out, they were republished as The Wanderings of Christopher Wagstaff, grandfather to Tristram Shandy.
It's probably in the Garland edition. Is it that the pink? It may be in there somewhere because that's all the.
There it is.
There we go.
There you go. The Life and Travels and Adventures of Christopher Wagstaff, Gentleman, Grandfather to Tristram Shandy. Oh,
brilliant. And just when you flick through there, it does look like they've really kind of gone for the...
Yeah, the dashes
the
a bit.
Dashes, too. And I saw some asterisks. And Frank, one of the brilliant things you do in your film adaptation of Tristram Shandy is in the first third of the film, we're in the world of Tristram Shandy. We're kind of watching the characters. And then there's this incredible moment a third of the way through where the camera pulls back and you see a camera crew filming the actors, and suddenly we're in the world of actors putting on this story. And so just like Stern is describing the writing of his novel, we see the making of this film. And there's even a writer who you call Joe, but it bears some resemblance to you in some ways. And so, was that an idea you'd had for a long time, or was that...
Oh, I had it for a very long time. I think Tristram Shandy was the first film I ever pitched to anybody. Really? And it took a long, long time before anybody picked it up. And for me, it was always about birth. But it always seemed like you would have to be a film about making films, of which there are not that many. But what I also was drawn to was the fact that a film crew, when it's working, is like a little village. And it's got a little hierarchy and there's people doing stuff. It's not a purely intellectual move.
It works so well. And you work into that crew, lots of the little hints at Stern gives us to his real life behind the book as well. He kind of gives a hint in the book about his mistress that he calls Jenny.
Yeah.
And so you very cleverly put in a runner called Jenny and Steve Coogan playing himself, Steve Coogan's wife in the film is called Jenny. And so all these...
Well, Coogan was perfect casting as well, wasn't he? Because he's done exactly what Stern has done. That he created this character who is uncomfortably like him.
Right.
That he will flip into and out of, and it's been with him his whole life, which is Alan Partridge.
Yes. Brilliant. Well, gosh, it's so exciting being in this room, but let's go and explore some of the rest of the house and talk about a couple of the few plot points which happen within this big book. Let's head out.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me, it can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel, explore.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Gosh, there's so many fascinating things on the walls.
This is a lovely room. This is a very comfortable...
It's a beautiful room, isn't it?
Convivial.
Frank, would you describe the room?
Well, it's beautifully lit. It's got two great big windows and the sun is pouring through them. And nice, bright colours. And it's considering it's such a low ceiling, it feels very convivial. It seems like a nice place to sit and chill and chat. And it feels very much the spirit of Tristan Shandy, actually.
Well, it's the end of the medieval building as well, which finishes then here. And then the bits behind me, two little half-room, were put on by Stern.
Right, okay.
He extended it. So he might have done it for light, as you...
Yeah, yes. Because he looks out into the gardens on that way.
Yeah.
I thought in here we could talk about one of the most comical scenes in the book. And Patrick, I was wondering if you'd be happy to read out passage, this top one here.
Trismegistus, said my father. But stay, thou art a leaky vessel, Susanna, added my father. Canst thou carry Trismegistus in thy head the length of the gallery without scattering? Can I? Cried Susanna, shutting the door in her huff. If she can, I'll be shot, said my father, bouncing out of bed in the dark and groping for his breeches. Susanna ran with all speed along the gallery. My father made all possible speed to find his breeches. Susanna got the start and kept it. Tris something, cried Susanna. There is no Christian name in the world, said the curate, beginning with Tris, but Tristram. Then Trismegistus, quoth Susanna. There's no gistus to it, noodle. 'Tis my own name, replied the curate, dipping his hand as he spoke into the basin. Tristram, said he, etc., 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 etc. So Tristram I was called, and Tristram shall I be to the day of my death.
Brilliant. Very well read, Patrick. And of course, the big joke there is that Walter Shandy has just been talking at length about how Trismegistus is the best name of all names, but the absolute worst name in the world is the name Tristram. So this, he's gone from kind of hoping to give his son this great blessing of this incredibly fortunate name, and through this kind of farcical episode, he ends up being called Tristram. Yeah. Just, it's a fantastic, just so well written, you know, such, but writing that in just one paragraph, it's a whole
or
scene.
Or Shaw. Yeah, it's absolutely. And it's so, and it's richer than that, isn't it? Because he's debated what's the best name to give him, but it's got an urgency to it as well, because Tristram's already had a terrible start. He's had this birth trauma where the bridge of his nose has been broken. So his father says, well, he's had these strikes against him, but we can give him this compensatory piece of magic, which is this amazing name.
Yeah.
And so off she goes with it, and he has to run after her with his bridges in his hands because he doesn't trust her. I think it's really worth noting that it's not Susanna who really gets it wrong.
No.
It's this guy mansplaining to her, saying, no, that's wrong.
Exactly.
And it's Tristram, just have it. You know?
And whose name is Tristram? I think that's Tristram, that's a cherry on the cake. Kieran is called Tristram.
Yeah, it's the worst name in the world. And there's, even before that, there's this little moment when, because the baby's being baptized quickly because he's black and he's choking and they think he's going to die, so they're quickly baptizing him in case he dies. So he has this sort of moment of stutter. He's thinking, well, I could call him Toby because Toby would like that, and then I won't have wasted this great name on a kid who's going to die anyway. I could throw him if he's going to die anyway. And then, of course, the minute he's baptized, he completely recovers. And it's one of those sequences where, because the book is very digressive, but every now and then there are these moments of incredible momentum and kind of Woodhouseian farce. And this is one of those, it's like, this is a real page-turning sequence where there's, the baby turning black, possibly dying, got to get baptized in time. What's his, oh God, get my breeches, go. And it's really rapid, it's really fast.
Rapid,
and it's building up to this terrible, terrible moment.
Well, if you're expecting to confront a traditional book with a traditional beginning, a middle and an end, then you're going to find either you're off on an adventure that you didn't know that you were going to take part in, or you get really irritated and frustrated and cross because it's not doing what it should do.
Yes, and he says at one point, if I were you, I'd throw this book at the wall because you'll be frustrated right now.
Yeah, I think it's worth saying that. It's all right to be frustrated by this book, and it is all right to dip into it wherever you want to. It's not a book that demands that you read it in a particular way.
Yes. Talking about reading, there's one passage where he turns to the reader and says, "Read, read, 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 my unlearned reader, read. Or by the knowledge of the great saint Paralipomenon, I tell you beforehand, you had better throw down the book at once." And this section introduces, we talked earlier about the black page, but the black page's sort of equivalent, which crops up later, is the marbled page.
The marbled page.
And this passage about the importance of reading introduces this page. He says, "Without much reading, by which your reverence knows I mean much knowledge, you will no more be able to penetrate the moral of the next marbled page, motley emblem of my work, than the world with all its sagacity has been able to unravel the many opinions, transactions, and truths which still lie mystically hid under the dark veil of the black one." And opposite those words is this beautifully...
And it's produced early editions.
Yes. So marbled paper would traditionally have been used for the end papers of a book.
Yeah.
And so Stern turns the book inside out by putting this marble page in the middle of it. And of course, in every different first edition, this would have been a unique page.
Because they're separately marbled.
Yes, individually marbled. And so I think, gosh, there's so much going on here, isn't it? There's so much about, it's almost like a Rorschach test or something, isn't it?
Yeah, that it's, you know, that part of it is that you take your own, everyone reads their own Tristram Shandy.
Yes.
You find your own way through it.
And he's also, at this point, he, as the writer, is relinquishing all responsibility for this page to somebody else.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And Patrick, you have so many different editions of Tristram Shandy over the years. How have people approached that page?
Well, some have ignored it. Completely, because it costs too much.
Right.
So when Stern dies, then you don't necessarily get any more motley emblems of anybody's work. In fact, you sometimes get those bits cut out.
Right.
In the same, which you don't tend to get with the black page. Often the black page, however, is represented for reasons which are beyond me. There's a French edition which reproduces the black page. It's a black and white checkerboard. Yeah. Why? You say, why have you done this?
Yes, if you can do the black squares.
Even the Everyman edition, the early Everyman edition, reproduced the black page as a miniature black page at the bottom of the page. You know, Stern is responsible for those first two volumes completely. He's designed them. It goes out into the world exactly as he wants
the
it to
artifacts
be.
Artifacts that so he's made. Yeah,
so we know that he wanted it to be this size, looking like that completely. Yeah. So although there is no manuscript, that covers it to some extent. But after he dies, people just play around with it. Because they're the editors who are going to decide how much blooming ink they're going to use on this and how much they're not. And it's very important to take this as being an artist's book.
Yes.
It's an artist's book because it's exactly the same as any other book, apparently, but it isn't. What you're holding in your hand is something which is about to explode with ideas, so many ideas that have hardly been touched upon, which we now accept as being perfectly, children are far more easily able to deal with complicated narrative structures and with jumps and leaps in time without any problem. But this is all pretty new.
Yeah, right.
Not brand new, but pretty new.
It's really exciting to see that because, for instance, in the Penguin Classics edition, it's a black and white reproduction printed. Of a printed page, and it's the same one in every copy. Yeah. So it's still a surprise and quite a stunning moment, but it's not as spectacular as that.
Yeah. And it's colour.
Well, that's the mischristening is one great scene in the book. Let's head upstairs for another of those great scenes.
Come this way.
I'll follow you, Frank.
Past various archbishops.
Yeah. Oh, what a gorgeous room.
Wow. God, isn't this lovely. So this was Lawrence Stern's bedroom.
Pretty sure, yeah.
We're pretty sure. And again, it's a beautiful day to see it on because the sun is pouring through the window. And of course, the bedroom has a sash window looking out onto the road outside.
And sends a chill,
to any man's bones. So this is another of the great moments in the book. And I'll read this one out. One of the tricky things about talking about Tristram Shandy in audio form is that there are a lot of visual jokes which is hard to get across, and one of those is that several words in this passage are blotted out with asterisks. But it's pretty obvious what the words are, so this is how it goes. The chambermaid had left no under the bed. "Cannot you contrive, master," quoth Susanna, lifting up the sash with one hand as she spoke and helping me up into the window seat with the other. "Cannot you manage, my dear, for a single time to—" I was 5 years old. Susanna did not consider that nothing was well hung in our family. So slap came the sash down like lightning upon us. "Nothing is left," cried Susanna. "Nothing is left for me but to run the country." There's so many jokes going on in that short paragraph. There's the asterisks, it's obvious that it's piss out of the window. And the joke about nothing being well hung, and then nothing is left. There's so many moments in the book where there's questions about
meaning,
yeah, double entendres, and particularly about emasculation and whether Toby and whether Tristram have all their equipment in one piece.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's a very bawdy book, and that was part of appeal, I'm sure it must have been.
It is, and yet it has a tone, doesn't it? I always think about that. You know, it opens with two people having sex.
Right.
But it's described in this sort of slightly biblical language as, I wish they'd minded what they're about when they begot me.
Mm. Yes.
You know, so straight away it's got a kind of dignity
raised
to it.
Raised eyebrows, yes.
Yeah. Which belies, the fact that really the core moment of the book is someone getting their willy trapped in the sash window.
Oh, God, the thought of it.
Which is connected with Toby.
Yes.
You know, it's because of Toby's groin that Tristram's groin
and,
is smashed.
And why is that? Why?
Because the reason that the sash window collapses on his willy is that Trim has taken the lead weights out of the window to help create this model of the Battle of Namur so that Toby can show people where he was injured.
There isn't a render where he reveals exactly that this is what he means.
Right.
So it couldn't not yes, necessarily yes. what you would deduce it
yes,
to be.
Right.
It's your mind reader.
Right.
It's God, your yes. mind reader.
Yes, there is that slightly Frankie Howard thing to it all. Yeah. Like, no, Mrs. Snow.
There's a lot. There's an extended
something else altogether.
Joke about noses, isn't there?
Yes.
And he's sort of talking about how it's very good to have a long nose, and women love a man with a long nose. And he keeps stopping, saying, "Read it. I only mean noses
I'm
by this." But the more
noses.
He says it, the more your mind goes elsewhere. That's brilliant. So yeah, there's lots of these tricks, aren't there? There's digressions, and Tristram famously says that digressions are the sunshine of life. And I mean, he says in that passage, he says, if you take digressions out of this book, for instance, you might as well take the book along with them. And actually, it's the digressions which make it such an enjoyable.
There's something about pace and omission, isn't there, as well? If that thing of like saying, we'll skip this bit, that makes you feel as though you're kind of gathering momentum. You know, like I always think that in Johnson, when you read in Johnson, that he'll start a book by saying, well, we won't be talking about, I'm going to talk about going to the Highlands and the Islands, and we won't be talking about this, and I won't be describing that. And you feel by the end of like one paragraph that you've skipped a book, you know, and you've got this feeling of, we're really going somewhere, we know what's going on. So when Stern like says, well, we'll miss a chapter here, he feels though, finally we're getting somewhere.
I love that bit where he cuts a chapter out, and then the funniest thing, because the page number suddenly skipped, and he says, if you've noticed the page number skipped, don't worry. I meant to take that chapter. And then his reason for taking it out, do you remember, is because the chapter was so good, it made everything else look bad. Yeah. So the whole thing is improved by taking out the best chapter.
And he also plays around with the way that the book is constructed, because he alters the way the pagination works. So it goes from being the odd numbers and the even numbers stop being that and are switched over. So he is deconstructing the way that the book is put together.
There's that bit where Toby's cut off in mid-sentence, and then it's kind of two volumes later or something that he finally finishes the sentence. And he's but there's lots of things which are kind of thrown up and then held
so
in
sometimes
suspension.
They come back in a completely temporal way. It's like you've fought that thing up.
Yeah.
Oh, it's back. That's funny. Uh-huh. It's funny that it's back. But sometimes they come back in a really substantial way, like the way Toby's obsession with his groin connects with poor old Tristram's groin in this.
Well, that feels
tragic.
Like a
sash collapse.
Well, why don't we follow Corporal Trim's footsteps? And that feels like a good moment to head outside and talk about the fortifications.
Don't touch the sash window.
We come out now into the garden, into the lawn alongside Shandy Hall, beautifully kept by Patrick and his partner Chris. And we can imagine on this beautiful, pretty smooth plot of lawn, we can imagine Uncle Toby and Corporal Trim setting about their fortifications. Frank, do you want to set this up? Like, what are they doing?
So, Toby has been at the Siege of Namur, where he's received his grievous blow, and he's obsessed with it. So he's always been making a model, and he makes it originally on a tray in bed, I think, something like that. And Trim has the idea of going large on this and doing it on the bowling green. And so they start to build a model of Namur and the Siege of Namur, using bits from the house, tragically, using the lead weights from the sash window as cannons. And they reconstruct this moment out here, which is such a great symbol of any kind of creative act. You know, you're trying to memorialise or reconstruct or rebuild a moment so that somebody else can understand it. But it's also bonkers. You know?
Well, a bit like the book, and it's a never-ending effort, is it? They're not going to finish doing this. Like, they're constantly replacing the bridges and sort of
and also it's so familiar, isn't it? It is, you know, a matchstick cathedral, all those sort of things that old blokes do, or people who've been through trauma do to kind of put themselves back together again. That thing of like trying to capture a moment to try to explain it in art, the therapeutic value of that. Well, but also the hobbyishness of it. And, you know, Toby has a hobby horse, and it is a hobby.
Yes.
But it's also got this kind of emotional weight to it, and it's also really, really, really funny.
And it's Trim's care and understanding of the situation that Uncle Toby is
in. And the tenderness of Trim, and him saying, like, I hadn't thought about that till now, but he literally gets him out of the house into the fresh air to do this. So he doesn't sort of try to persuade him away from pondering on this moment. He says, come and ponder on it out here, and we'll do it together, and it'll be fun. And we'll castrate your nephew accidentally in the process. And that's what it's always like when you're describing this book, is that you kind of go off on this thing of like a beautiful sentimental idea, and then it will always lead you somewhere terrible.
But that relationship between Trim and Toby is beautiful, isn't it?
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. very affectionate.
Where he stands behind the chair. You know, Uncle Toby doesn't want him to stand behind the chair. He wants him to sit down, or he wants him to leave it. You know, yeah. But he's always there making sure that everything is all right.
And also that thing that I think is really important about this book is that the working class characters, the servants, yeah. have lots of agency.
Yes.
This is Trim's idea. It's Trim who took the lead weights out of the sash yeah. windows and also cut up Walter's favourite boots,
yes.
his jack boots. The jack boots are my favourite thing in the world. He says, I won't chop them up.
Of all the things.
And of course it's at the fortifications that Toby is wooed by the Widow Wadman.
The Widow Wadman intrudes yes. herself into it and says, I have something in my eye. And it's not in the white.
Squeezing herself down.
I don't know why that feels so suggestive. Yes. It's like kind of, she's like a very forward version of Brief Encounter, where she kind of imposes herself on this man who says, I don't know one end of a woman from the other. And she's very keen to know where he's injured, which gives rise to lots of puns about what his injury might imply. And then he says, I'll show you the very spot in which I was injured. And she gets very flustered about the possibility of looking up where she thinks he might be injured.
Yes, about to reveal.
And then he takes her out onto the lawn and
shows her
he says,
very...
I'll put your finger on it.
And Patrick, what was Lawrence Stern's love life like? Was he a shy and retiring as Toby, or was
Wish I knew. I mean, his association with his wife was it seems to be a sort of compatible association, the fact that she was in the south of France with his daughter and he wasn't.
Right.
Although he did go over on a number of occasions. But he had a sort of a rather intense relationship with a young woman called Eliza Draper, who he met in London. And she was but 22 and married with children, and he was 53.
Her husband was in India, right?
Yeah. And the relationship between Lawrence Stern and Eliza is one that is, you could speculate on quite easily, because he writes the most beautiful letters to her, although we don't have the originals. I think it's important to know what's real and what's not real, and what sort of people are making up as being what they think it is, because those letters don't exist that we can see. There are some reproductions of some of the letters that Eliza is supposed to have written to Stern, but they also have mysteriously disappeared since the 1920s. And we can't be absolutely certain, but he does use that relationship that he does have with her to produce another voice. You've got Stern's voice of Tristram Shandy, you've got Stern's voice from the pulpit. Mm-hmm. We've got Yorick's voice, which is slightly different in Sentimental Journey, and we've got this other voice, which is the letters to Eliza. And it's like reading a different person. I mean, he describes the room that he's getting ready for her. He describes all the places that he walks. And it's they're love poems. You know, they're love letters. But is he just playing around with writing love letters?
Yeah.
I don't mean to make him tricksy all the time, but he is tricksy all the time. So therefore, you can never be absolutely sure.
Well, writing's a game.
You will know. Well, you
yeah,
will know.
It is a game. You know, yeah. He's playing a game.
There's a moment in Sentimental Journey when Parson Yorick, who is not the same as Stern, but in some ways similar, says that he's been in love with one princess or another almost all my life, and I hope I shall go on so till I die. And I find that an interesting line, that maybe that's how he saw himself, even if it wasn't something he acted on. Or yeah, it's intriguing to speculate, isn't it?
Mm.
And you were saying there is a room in the house that... was the room that
well
he
described by him? He describes how it's going to be, and they're going to be a set of apartments, and they're going to be perfect. There's a powder room been made. Everything is ready and waiting for her to come, but she doesn't come. She never actually gets here. He dies.
Mm. Well, on that note, let's head to our final location, the garden room. So we've just come in from the garden into the extension that Stern put onto the house, and this feels like an appropriate spot to bring our conversation towards an end. In a letter in July 1766, he wrote, "At present I am in my peaceful retreat, writing the ninth volume of Tristram," which turned out to be the last one. "I shall publish but one volume this year, and the next I shall begin a new work of four volumes, which when finished I shall continue Tristram with fresh spirit. And of course that work of four volumes was A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy, of which he only wrote two volumes. And Laurence Sterne died in March 1768 of complications from flu and pleurisy, just 1 month after those first two volumes of A Sentimental Journey were published. Now, Samuel Johnson, contemporary of Sterne, famously said that nothing odd will do long. Tristram Shandy did not last. And, I mean, it just feels completely wrong, doesn't it? I mean, Frank, why do you think it is that Tristram Shandy has lasted and continues to inspire people?
I think because it's fun is one thing. And I think appropriately, the idea of liberty is at the heart of it, that I don't think any reader or writer reads that. I get that, you know, you can find it a frustrating read, but you come to that book and you feel set free. You're set free from the exigencies of time and the traditions of the novel. It is this huge kind of, it's like Alice in that way, of that it's like, it's just, it throws everything in the face. And at the same time, that sounds like quite an intellectual thing, but at its heart, it's this incredibly warm thing that deals with core human experiences that are often neglected by the great novelists or great artists. You know, it's about birth. It's about loving your baby as it's born. It's about friendship. It's about loyalty. And it's about death. You know, these huge, huge themes dealt with in this deft, light-hearted manner that says you can wear life lightly, you know? Mm-hmm. And that life is a joke, you know, that you will finish mid-sentence. Yes. You will have planned four more volumes. You will die in jest. And that's to be treasured. That's to be relished. That's not a bad thing.
Mm. Frank, are there any specific authors or artists that you can think of who've used the legacy of Tristram Shandy?
I love to stumble across the shrapnel from the explosion and see where it's landed, because it's often in quite unexpected places. There are literary things like in B.S. Johnson, in Travelling People, he's got the black page.
Well, that's a grey page, to begin with, because he's feeling a bit dicky.
That's right.
And then he recovers from that, the character, and then sadly, oh, it says no. And then we have
a double black page.
Yeah. B.S. Johnson does feel very sort of shabby.
Oh, yeah, hugely.
With holes in the pages.
Unexpected places as well, like Jamie Reid when he did the cover of Anarchy in the UK, the Sex Pistols single, that's the black page. Nice. And having heard him talk about that, I realised that the Beatles' White Album is a kind of anti-black page.
Right.
So people who've kind of clocked it. And I love Princess Bride, which is one of my favourite films.
Yes, me too.
Lynn Kaufman. And the book of the Princess Bride does exactly a very, very Shandian thing, which is that it purports to be a synopsis of another book that doesn't exist. And then when you watch the movie, Peter Falk does those bits to the kid. So the kid will stop and go, oh, there's kissing, I'm not interested. And so it'll stop and then come back later. And they say, actually, you can stay with this kiss. So you can just pick it up in different places. Yes. Whenever I see that, I always feel cheered, because it's that kind of fellow feeling of someone else has read it and found something.
Experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the book ends I would say two ways. And I think what you do, Frank, in A Cock and Bull Story is dramatise both the ways in which it ends. So the text of the book ends with this kind of yet another digression about Walter Shandy's bull, who's serving all the cows in the local area. And the two final lines are given to Tristram's mother, Elizabeth, also the name of his wife, and Parson Yorick, the sort of version of him. And it goes, "Lord," said my mother, "what is all this story about?" "A cock and a bull," said Yorick, "and one of the best of its kind I ever heard." So that's the final sentence, and it's a great way to finish the book, because, of course, the whole story is a cock and bull story. It's, you know, what if you've been led uphill down dale? And then as a reader, you shut the book, and I think that's the second ending, where you close this physical book that has been a kind of firecracker in your hands, and you then live the rest of your life changed because you've read definitely. This book. And what you do so brilliantly in the film adaptation is you have that final scene, and then a few seconds later, the film suddenly becomes the screening of the finished film. And there's one more pullback. So the actors who are playing themselves pull back to be the actors playing themselves. And I think that final twist is just such a brilliant way to end the film.
Yeah, and slightly disappointed with the film as well. Right. Which is like, this is great. You know, that's...
it didn't really work.
Yeah, it didn't really work. Yeah. Which is very Shandian, isn't it?
Very, Well, Frank, Patrick, thank you so much both for talking about Tristram Shandy today. It's been such a pleasure to move around Shandy Hall and discuss this wonderful book with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks to Frank Cottrell Boyce, Patrick Wildgust, Shandy Hall and the Lawrence Stern Trust, and to our kind partners, Penguin Classics. I'm Henry Elliott, the producer is Andrea Rangecroft, and the music is by Don Gould. If you enjoyed this episode of On the Road with Penguin Classics, please spread the word and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, let's sign off with Stern's own words about the health benefits of reading Tristram Shandy from the end of Volume 4. Now that you have just got to the end of these volumes, the thing I have to ask is how you feel your heads. My own aches dismally. As for your healths, I know they are much better. True Shandyism, think what you will against it, opens the hearts and lungs, and like all those affections which partake of its nature, it forces the blood and other vital fluids of the body to run freely through its channels and make the wheel of life run long and cheerfully round.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.